Yes, but why? James Drake, smoking his cigarette slowly and patiently, sat on the staircase, third step from the bottom, and nodded slightly as Thomas Trumbull strode toward him. Trumbull was almost always the last to arrive at the monthly Black Widower's banquet, but this time he was not quite as late as he often was. Drake stood up, and Trumbull, breaking suddenly, said inevitably, "Why are you waiting down here, Jim?" "To talk to you. You're the only one I haven't been able to reach this last week. Why don't you get an answering service or an answering machine?"
"Because," growled Trumbull, "I don't want to be too damned accessible, and I don't want too many messages. Those who need to reach me know how."
"Exactly. I needed to."
"All right, now you have me. What's up?"
He scowled suddenly.
"Bad news?"
"No. Puzzling news. A week ago, Henry called me."
"What Henry? A waiter?"
"What other Henry would I be referring to on Black Widower's night, Tom? Of course our waiter. He called me because it's my turn to host the shindig tonight, and he asked me if it would be possible for me to refrain from bringing a guest." Trumbull registered utter surprise.
"Why?"
"The point is, he wants to be the guest."
"He? Who'll wait on us?"
"No, no. He'll do the waiting, as always. He's not suggesting he sit down and eat with us, though he could if he wished. He's a member of the club."
"I know," said Trumbull. "The best one among us. But what's it all about, then?"
"He wants to be grilled after the banquet. He's got a problem."
"He's got a problem?"
Trumbull's voice went up half an octave in several decibels. Drake put a finger to his lips and looked apprehensively up the stairs to where the four others were having their drinks.
"Keep it down."
"Yes, he does."
"What kind of problem?"
"He didn't say."
"But he's the one who always solves the problems. I don't recall a single time when any of the others of us have managed."
"I know, I know. I told him that," said Drake. "He said he's too close to it and he wants our help. Well, listen, I just couldn't refuse him."
"No," said Trumbull. "Of course not. But it could create problems."
"I know. I've arranged to have Manny Rubin talk about the plot of the mystery novel he's working on now. So don't you stop him this time. We need normal conversation during the dinner, or we might embarrass Henry."
"Very well, I'll let him talk. But it surely goes against the grain to hear him pontificate on mystery writing."
The turtle soup and the crab salad had gone the way of all flesh, and the roast lamb was being brought on. Emmanuel Rubin drew a breath and continued to speak.
"But what you have to be most careful of is the motive. Suppose you have a traditional murder mystery with a closed cast of characters. One of the individuals in the book committed the murder, and you know for a fact that no outsider could possibly be involved. Well, they might all have access to the means by which the murder was committed. They might all have had the opportunity. You might arrange for no one to have an alibi. That part is easy. But now comes the question of motive. If one of the characters has an overwhelming motive for killing the victim and everyone else stands only to lose heavily by his death, then you make it almost certain that the person with the motive committed the crime. There are several ways out of it. You can make the victim so saintly a person that no one would seem to have a motive for killing him. Or you can make the victim so evil a person that everyone would have a motive for killing him. Or..."
Mario Gonzalo interrupted. "You can have a character with a hidden motive, can't you?"
Rubin stared at him hotly through the thick lenses of his glasses, and his sparse beard seemed to bristle.
"I said or, Mario. Do you mind if I finish?"
"Go ahead," said Geoffrey Avalon, in his impressive baritone.
"You know no one can stop you when you're in full flight."
Rubin said, "Or, to finish what I was saying, you can indeed give one person an overwhelming motive, but you can give another character, or several others, motives that are not known at the start and are only gradually revealed."
Roger Halstead said, "It's for that reason I always know for sure that the character with the overwhelming motive is innocent."
"Every once in a while, wise guy," said Rubin, "a clever writer can turn the tables, and having forced attention away from the obvious killer, reveal him as the killer after all."
Rubin went into greater detail, but the conversation began to flag when the coffee and dessert showed up. The evil moment could not be long delayed, and when Henry served the brandy, having maintained his imperturbable countenance throughout,
Drake, with a sinking sensation, clattered his spoon against his water glass.
"Gentlemen," he said, "as you all know, our esteemed Henry, the man who makes these banquets what they are, wishes to present a problem to us. I have made it quite plain that our record in these matters is an abysmally poor one, but he will have it so, and, of course, we are always at his service figuratively, as he is at ours literally. So, Henry, please take a seat at the table."
Henry demurred. "That would not be at all necessary, Dr. Drake."
"Host's decision, Henry. You're a member of the club, and from this moment on you're a partaker of the banquet. Sit down. Mario, drag up a chair."
With a slight nod, Henry seated himself.
Drake said to Halstead, "Roger, you've got the softest voice and are the least opinionated of us, so why don't you do the grilling?"
Halstead took a gentle sip of his Grand Marnier and said, "Henry, I won't ask you to begin by justifying your existence. We know very well how your existence is justified. It is by seeing to it that we have the best banquets in the city, or perhaps in the world. But we want those banquets to continue. Would you object to having us probe into your private life? To have us question what you have to say? To have us try to catch you out in your own statements? In short, will this ruin our relationship?"
Henry said gently, "I have myself asked for this session, Mr. Halstead. I have heard the manner in which you have grilled dozens of guests, and I am ready to take my turn."
A silence fell over the table, and after a full minute Halstead said, "It's obvious, Henry, that each of us is reluctant to question you, despite your offer to be grilled. May we therefore start with you? Could you tell us in your own words what problem is disturbing you? And perhaps as you speak, questions may occur to us, and we may ask them."
"As you wish," said Henry. He paused as though collecting his thoughts, then said, "Gentlemen, we have had a long and happy association. Happy on my part, certainly. But it has been, if I may use the expression, a purely professional one. The circumstances of my private life are unknown to you, I believe. You have never questioned me, and I have never forced my confidences on you, till now. Gentlemen, as some of you may have taken for granted, I am not married."
Avalon said softly, "Have you ever been married, Henry?"
"No, Mr. Avalon, never. I am an old bachelor, and growing older. As you have no doubt heard, old bachelors become accustomed to their own ways, and as the years pass, their singleness becomes ever more precious to them, though there are times, since even old bachelors are human, when they feel lonely. There is a woman—"
"Aha!" said Gonzalo, lifting one finger, then falling silent as though abashed.
"Yes," said Henry, with a small smile. "I have in my lifetime made friends with those of the opposite sex, and have even engaged in some romantic situations, but not so much in recent years. For the last year and a half, though, I have known a woman only slightly younger than myself who has been a good friend. Her name is Hester Amberley, and that is her real name. I know better than anyone else the conditions of confidentiality that exist at these banquets, and so there is no need to conceal anything. Hester is as old-fashioned as her name, in fact, as old-fashioned as I am. We have quiet times. We discuss books and the news of the day. We take strolls in the park. We enjoy the newly refurbished Central Park Zoo. We occasionally take in a show. It is a quiet life, but one that is very satisfying. She was married in the past and is a widow, but she has a modest competence as a result. We each have a comfortable apartment. Neither of us has financial problems. We are each accustomed to a single life, and it really has the potential for an idyllic existence. What we supply each other with is company and a community of interests. Nothing could be more convenient and delightful, until there came a time when—"
"Aha!" said Gonzalo again. "A serpent enters the Garden of Eden. Another man, Henry."
"Oh, no," said Henry. "Nor another woman, either. We are each of us beyond the point where we are searching out adventures. Besides, our friendship is sufficiently sensible to continue, I believe, even if third parties had made their appearance. No, the interfering phenomenon is something much more disturbing."
Avalon said, "I would suggest, Henry, that you move on to this interfering phenomenon and tell us what it is."
"In two words, Mr. Avalon, it's anonymous letters."
"Blackmail?"
Avalon's eyebrows were raised in surprise. Henry hesitated. "I can't say blackmail. Simply anonymous letters."
"Suppose you tell us about them," said Halstead gently.
"They started arriving in the mail a bit over 2 months ago.
They are short letters, printed in straggly fashion on cheap paper, in cheap envelopes. They seem almost illiterate, but the words are spelled correctly, and I suppose they were printed with the left hand, or the right hand if the writer was left-handed.
Have you seen them yourself?
Put in Gonzalo abruptly.
Yes, I have, Mr. Gonzalo. Three of them.
Hester destroyed the first few, being very upset and not thinking clearly, I suppose. But when she couldn't stand it any more, she turned to me for help and showed me three letters she had not destroyed. The paper and the envelopes are untraceable, I'm sure, and the postmarks indicate no more than that the letters were mailed here in the city. Hester did not think to handle them with gloves, but the writer was being so careful that I imagine he or she was careful to leave no fingerprints.
Halstead said, "Is it possible to tell us what the letters are about? Why they upset her so?"
Henry's mouth twitched as though he were meditating a smile, and thought better of it.
"They accuse her of various crimes, but quite minor ones. Hester is not the woman to have had a past that included murder, theft, or any of the more grandiose criminal activities."
"And she's not accused of them?" said Halstead.
"Not at all. Of the three letters I saw, one accused her of having bought lipstick at the age of 16, after her mother had strictly forbidden her to. One, that she had had dinner with a male friend once when her husband was out of town. It mentioned the dinner, and it suggested nothing more. The third reminded her that she routinely used company postage for her private mail."
Drake said, thoughtfully, "Those were only the three letters she showed you. Might not some of the letters she didn't show you contain meatier matter?"
"It is possible, but Hester insists that these three are entirely typical, and I believe her. I have never found her dishonest or devious, even when honesty was inconvenient."
Drake shrugged, as though unconvinced, but he said, "In that case, if we accept your friend's statement, why should these things bother her? If I had a dollar for every teenager who buys and uses lipstick against parental instructions, for every employee who raids the petty cash box, I'd be a rich man."
"They bother her, Dr. Drake, because she doesn't know who's sending them."
Reuben said, "Let's be logical. Just from the three letters you described, it's someone who knew her well enough to describe her high crimes and misdemeanors as an adolescent as well as a mature woman. So it must be someone who's known her all her life. There can't be many of those."
"Worse than that, Mr. Reuben, there aren't any of those. Hester was born in Ames, Iowa, and moved to New York when she had turned 22. Except for two brief visits in the 1950s, she has not been back to Ames. No one she knew there is here in New York."
"How can she know that?" said Reuben.
"Well, if any are here in New York, Mr. Reuben, they haven't made themselves known to her."
Halstead said, "Some 30 years have passed since her last visit. It's possible an old Ames acquaintance might not want to be known to her. She or he may be working at her place of business, and she's never really paid attention to her or him, and might not recognize the person if she did."
Gonzalo said, "Wait a while. Why does it have to be someone who's known her all her life? These days no one has any privacy. Everything's on computers. If someone tapped into the computers, which hackers seem to be doing all the time, they could find out anything they want."
"No, they can't, Mario," said Avalon, censoriously. "You're just being paranoid about computers. I don't deny that computers are full of details about the financial and medical histories of various people, and I admit this raises the possibility of enormous invasions of privacy. But the computers don't hold everything. You don't suppose any time a person takes a stamp from the postage drawer, a relay is tripped and the fact is recorded in a computer under the person's name, address, and social security number, do you? Or that every time a teenager explores the boundaries of parental permission, those computers are activated. And some 40 years ago at that, in Mrs. Amberley's case."
Gonzalo was on the defensive.
"They can find out enough. They can find out she was born in Ames, Iowa, and they could go there to gather information about her younger years."
"Why on earth would they do that?" asked Trumbull indignantly. "Who would make a round trip of 2,000 miles and spend who knows how much time just to pick up a lipstick misdemeanor?"
Henry said,
"That indeed is one of the difficulties. The perpetrator is someone who has known Hester all her life, and intimately too, or who can find out, without impossible trouble, the necessary details, because apparently all of the sins of which Hester is accused, while minor in the extreme, are real. Anyone who has known her that long and that well, she would recognize, and she says there is no one."
"That's not definite enough," insisted Trumbull. With the best will in the world, she might not recognize something she's not really looking for. Someone who's not courting exposure would deliberately adopt some sort of simple disguise.
Or else, said Gonzalo in excitement, it might not be one person at all. It could be two people. One who knows all the wrong things she's doing now, and one who remembers the terrible things she did as a youngster, and whom she never even sees. And those two are pooling their efforts.
Avalon said, I believe we can fairly say if there is a person, or persons, unknown, who is working so hard to make your friend uncomfortable, Henry, it must be someone, or some people, who dislike her intensely. Now it strikes me that it is quite unlikely that person A would hate person B sufficiently to do this sort of thing, without person B being aware of person A's hate. I have a pretty good idea which of the people I am thrown amongst dislike me, and if one of them disliked me that much, I'm sure I'd know which one it was.
Henry said, There is much in what you say, Mr. Avalon.
Well then, said Avalon, the bit about the stamp you sounds as though it comes from a fellow employee. Where does Mrs. Amberley work, and what does she do?
She's a mid-level executive at one of the city's department stores, Mr. Avalon.
Is she in a position to have fired someone who might be taking revenge? Has she, I don't say she has, and I use it only as an example, snatched up someone's boyfriend or done something else that may have earned her a virulent disregard?
No, I'm sure nothing of this sort can be true. It did occur to me, as a matter of fact, that a particular hatred must be at the bottom of this, and I questioned her thoroughly on all her co-workers. She denies absolutely that any of them could possibly dislike her enough or have characters sufficiently psychotic to do this. It is my experience that people who feel ill-used are quite ready to find other people they know who they feel might be responsible and to blacken their reputations freely. Hester is not likely to do so simply as a matter of course, but she is human enough not to spare someone that she honestly thought would entertain feelings of anger toward her. She says emphatically that no one she knows is likely to choose this course of action, to send her repeated anonymous letters outlining the shady patches of her life.
You know, said Halstead, we're being entirely too rational about this. In the first place, we're assuming people send anonymous letters only out of dreadful hatred, but actually there can be no logic to it at all. Someone has time hanging heavy on her or his hands, and this seems like an interesting game to play, so it's done. No real reason is involved, and therefore we can't really expect to work it out by logic. It's just a matter of impulse and a warped notion of fun. And how does impulse and fun explain knowing all the intimate details of Mrs. Amberley's life? Asked Avalon, with a touch of sarcasm. That's not so hard either, said Halstead. People are always talking to each other and reminiscing and telling funny stories. Afterward, you're not even likely to remember what you said. It's quite possible, for instance, that Hester might have told somebody some story that seemed apropos at the time. A story about the first time she bought lipstick and used it and put it on all wrong or forgot to wipe all of it off when she came home and got into trouble, or who knows what. All of these things where you wonder, now how could they possibly know that, are known because you talk about it to everyone. I know something Manny did at a voucher con about 8 years ago, for instance, that he probably forgot he told me. No, I haven't, said Reuben hastily. But I deny it absolutely, Roger, and I'll kill you positively if you say another word on the subject.
I have no intention of doing so, said Halstead haughtily. I'm merely making a point. It's a valid point, Mr. Halstead, said Henry. But that sort of thing had occurred to me, and I questioned Hester on the matter, and she's sure she never talked about these things to her friends at work.
She can be sure all she wants, said Halstead. My point is she wouldn't even remember doing so.
Perhaps you are right, said Henry. But I have always found Hester to be a reserved individual who talks very little about her private life. In fact, the qualities of reserve and privacy that both she and I exhibit are among the common factors that draw us together and make our friendship a good one.
Gonzalo shook his head. What's the use of coming to us with this problem, Henry? You've thought of everything we've thought of. You've probably thought of a few things we haven't thought of and aren't likely to think of.
It's true that I've expended some time on considering the various possibilities concerning the identity of the writer of these letters, but that is not the thing that really bothers me. Even though I have not come to any conclusion as to the identity of the writer, there's something else that puzzles me more.
What is that?
asked Reuben.
"By a curious coincidence, Mr. Reuben," said Henry, "you spoke at length during dinner concerning the problem of motivation in the stories you write, and it is precisely the problem of motivation that most concerns me in this matter. It has left me so thoroughly at sea that I determined to throw myself on the mercy and minds of the Black Widowers. After all, no matter what any of you might suggest as to the writer of the letters, I would have to answer yes, but why? Regardless of who is sending these letters, why are they being sent?"
The Black Widowers stared at Henry wordlessly. Henry went on.
"You see, it is natural to assume that anonymous letters are sent for a purpose. They may be setting the stage for blackmail or demands for money. They may be aimed at creating a sense of power in the writer and helplessness in the recipient that feeds the sadism of the former. The writer may be trying to make the recipient of the letters feel that at any moment the writer will reveal the nature of the accusations to a husband, to a wife, to leaders of the community. The letters would seem to threaten the blasting of the family life of the recipient, the social life, the political or commercial ambitions, or whatever. But none of this is true in Hester's case. There is no suggestion of any payoff, and if there were, Hester is not in a position to pay a large sum of money. Whoever writes these letters obviously knows her well enough to know that. Furthermore, there is no one she need fear. She has no husband, no family, no ambitions to smash, and the missteps of which she is accused, they can scarcely be taken seriously. Even if, for instance, it came to be known that she helped herself to the corporate postage, she would get no more than a headshake as a result."
"But the letters do make her feel rotten just the same, don't they?" said Gonzalo.
"Well, yes, they do," said Henry. "It goes beyond logic, as so many things do. She feels humiliated that someone, anyone, should know so much about her and should take such delight in displaying the knowledge to her. A few of the letters which I did not see were apparently intensely embarrassing in revealing some of her more intimate faux pas. She did not tell me what they were, and I did not press her, of course. In fact," he paused a moment, and Trumbull said encouragingly,
"Yes, Henry?"
"It has bothered her enough to induce what is almost a personality change. Hester has, all the time I have known her, been proud and independent, and now she has become tearful and weak. She almost clings to me. It bothers me that I'm not of more use to her, especially since I had told her—" He paused again.
Drake cleared his throat and stubbed out his cigarette.
"Did you tell her that you solved problems for us, Henry?"
Henry did not meet his eyes.
"No, Dr. Drake. Not in so many words, and of course never, not at any time, did I mention specifically anything that has gone on within this room. Somehow, though, I did manage to get across the notion that I was rather good at solving problems. I couldn't tell you exactly how I did it, but I see now, looking back upon it, that I have been vain about my abilities, improperly so, and I am justly punished. I don't remember when I fell prey in this fashion to my own vainglory, but when, after that, this problem of the anonymous letters arose, she naturally turned to me. I can't blame her for that. Now I have failed, and while that serves me right, I am distressed that she is suffering as a result of my incapacity as well. Somehow her misery has had a powerful effect on me. I want almost excessively to help her, and I have become greatly diminished in my own eyes at not being able to."
Halstead said, "Don't put yourself on the rack for this, Henry. I said earlier that people tell more about themselves than they are aware of. Why shouldn't you fall victim to this as well? You're a member of the human race with a considerably larger than average share of the good points it possesses. You can't be blamed if you possess a few of the shortcomings."
Henry shook his head, unsolaced.
Reuben put both his elbows on the table and stared across it at the seated Henry.
"Henry," he said, "I'm going to suggest something. I don't want to. Actually, I think that the suggestion is unbelievable. However, if there is one thing we have all learned from you, it is to put aside complicated solutions and go for the simplest one. I would like to. Have I your permission?"
"Of course, Mr. Reuben."
"However ridiculous it may sound?"
"Certainly, Mr. Reuben."
"You've known Hester for a year and a half now."
"Nearer to 2 years, actually."
"And the greatest pleasure you two have had has been your conversations, your discussions that must have ranged wherever they were led, and upon which no bars or limits were set."
Henry smiled faintly.
There is always the limit of good taste, which slowly becomes blurred as time goes on. She must have told you a great many things about herself.
Some things?
She probably told you more than she told anyone else. Henry, did you write the letters?
There was an instant stir all around the table, a palpable outcry of indignation. Reuben raised his arm.
Now hold it, all of you. It's a legitimate question.
His voice became stentorian, rising above the hubbub.
We have decided it is unlikely that any childhood chum could possibly know what she's doing now, unless she's working at the department store in disguise, which really seems unlikely. We are told Hester believes that no one at work dislikes her sufficiently to do this, even if they knew her youthful peccadilloes, which seems entirely unlikely, too. And frankly, I think that there is no chance whatever that two or more people are working together on this. Yet someone is writing these letters. Henry knows her best. Henry has the opportunity. I'll bet you anything that Henry thinks it is legitimate and sensible to suspect him.
Henry nodded his head. It is. I must admit that the possibility would never have occurred to me, for I know that I didn't write the letters. You others, however, can't know that, and if so, I must admit I seem a proper and possible suspect. The only thing is...
Well, said Reuben.
We are back to my chief question. Yes, but why? Suppose I had written the letters. You must explain why I should have done so.
Reuben said, I might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb. Henry, in all this, we only know what you have told us. You tell us that you have a pleasant relationship with this woman. In fact, from what you say, your relationship has grown warmer since this trouble started. But this is only what you tell us. Suppose you actually dislike this woman so intensely for some reason that you want to make her miserable.
There were shouts of anger from the others.
Avalon thundered, I would like to assure Henry that we accept every word he has told us as complete and unperverted truth. All right, shouted Reuben in return. I think so, too. But we're investigating a problem, and any possible solution depends upon whether the initial conditions given us are correct. I don't for a minute doubt Henry's word, but I would like some evidence that does not rest entirely on his word, just as a matter of form.
Henry shook his head. I cannot supply it. It had never occurred to me that I ought to come here with such proof, and even if I had, what could I have done but brought a letter which you might have thought I had written myself, or brought Hester herself, whom you might have thought was playing some sort of game in cooperation with me. All I can do is ask once again, yes, but why? Suppose that indeed I hated Hester and wished to make her miserable out of malevolence of spirit. Why then should I come to you with a false story? Why?
Reuben said, I'm still following this hypothetical thread of argument. You are doing it to face us with an insoluble problem for the fun of it.
And again, why? The pleasure of the warmth of my relationship with the Black Widowers would be at risk if I did such a thing. It is inconceivable to me that I would take such a risk.
And to us, said Gonzalo fiercely. And to me, said Reuben, even though I played devil's advocate. Still, it means there is no solution.
Henry said, On the contrary, Mr. Reuben, I am now quite certain I have the solution, thanks to the Black Widowers.
What? Roared Reuben. What solution?
As I said at the start, I may have been too close to the problem to see the matter clearly. The questions of the Black Widowers, particularly that of Mr. Reuben, delivered from a greater distance and with a greater detachment, put everything in a new light. I have learned from Mr. Reuben to think the unthinkable. After all, there is someone who knows more about Hester than even I know, and who could have written the letters more easily than myself.
And who would that be? Asked Trumbull.
Why, Hester herself.
And if over the preceding 5 minutes the banquet of the Black Widowers had been noisier than ever before, it was now struck with dead silence.
Finally, Halstead said, To ask you your question, Henry.
Yes, but why?
If finding a motive for you is difficult, then how on earth can we find a motive for her?
Somehow, said Henry, his face a trifle pink, I think I see why, and it is somewhat embarrassing.
Tell us,
trumpeted Reuben.
I have told you, said Henry, that she is a reserved and independent woman.
that we have had a cool and entirely intellectual companionship. It may be, perhaps, and here he grew a trifle pinker, that she found herself dissatisfied with that companionship. She knew that I pride myself on being able to see into a complex situation, and it may be she plotted one in which I would fail.
Yes, but why? Said Reuben.
So that she would have a reasonable excuse to be distressed and weak for a considerable length of time. So that she would become dependent on me and cling to me. So that I would be concerned about her and become more involved with her.
Reuben drew back in indignation.
Do you mean that this woman has been plotting to trap you into some kind of love affair?
Or marriage?
Yes. I rather admire her cleverness in doing this. Cleverness, said Reuben. Dirty tricks. You just tell her you're not to be snared in that fashion.
Actually, said Henry, his face now quite red, it's too late for that. I rather think she has succeeded.
Henry! Came the universal cry.
But even if worse comes to worst, said Henry, I shall not leave my position with the club. I promise you that.